everyone. Welcome to the Introduction to Clinical Research podcast. My name is Debbie and I use she, her pronouns. I work in clinical research and I have decided to explain it to my friend Elise. Say hello, Elise.
Hello, Elise. God, how many episodes in are we and we're still doing that joke?
Too many. Tried to stifle my laugh, but you saw me laughing.
We need to embrace that sometimes jokes do have to die, I think, at some point with this one.
How dare you? I will always be here for a bit.
Okay, I'm not letting this go. I guess we're committed. Hello, my name is Elise. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I don't work in clinical research, but actually today you might find out more about what I do work in for once. Debbie, back to you.
Sizzle, sizzle. Awesome. All right. We're here to pull the curtain back on medical research, so hopefully you feel more informed and that you can trust the outcomes of research a bit more. There's a lot we can discuss. We're going to take it bit by bit. And today, guess where we're going, friends? That's right. It's back to Elise's little goblin corner.
The dust and cobwebs seem to have been removed.
What's happening? Seems weird.
Seems weird,
over to
yes.
You in your corner.
Yes, I cleared off some of the cobwebs just for you so that when you walk in, you don't have to get a face full of spiders immediately, but don't look too closely into the corners.
Okay.
Yes, hello. So today we are going to be talking about CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and specifically how research into CPR occurs, because this is still a clinical research podcast, and I want to focus on the research aspect of it because it's interesting.
Nice.
Yes.
Good topic selection. I'm so interested.
Great. Well, I think that this might be a good time to acknowledge that we've kind of danced around my field of work in weird ways, where I'm like, oh yeah, behavioral health, oh, disasters, but public health, right? But very seldom have we actually named what I do. We're not hiding anything about what I do. It just isn't super relevant to the podcast all the time. But my three goblin topics have now been Narcan, ketamine therapy, and CPR. So I thought maybe we should tie those things together and connect those dots a little bit.
Nice.
Yes. Yep. So I work in a weird little niche side field of public health.
Sorry, niche. Do you mean niche?
Niche. Yeah. Weird little niche side field of public health.
Niche how you say it in America?
A lot of people say niche. The way I have experienced this word is that both pronunciations are correct situation.
Okay, no, I'm fine with that. Based. Scone and scone. It's scone and scone. Niche and niche. Mm-hmm. All right, well, learn something every day. Sorry for correcting you.
I do think more people say niche than niche, though.
I've never heard niche before, so thus my surprise, but more than happy to be wrong.
Okay, so my little niche in the public health field is called disaster behavioral health. So in a few words, this means my job is about helping the behavioral health workforce prepare and respond to disasters and the impacts, specifically the behavioral health impacts that disasters have on communities. So I know that's pretty vague. For example, in the immediate aftermath of a wildfire, people who aren't physically hurt will be cleared by first responders to go to a shelter rather than a hospital, or perhaps to their friend's house or their family's house or something, but they can leave the disaster area. And often they'll go to a shelter at the beginning. And at the shelter, they might be experiencing a lot of stress, fear, and emotional turmoil. They may not know where their friends and family are. They may not know if their house survived the fire, things like that. So a behavioral health responder might be present to help stabilize them and restore some of their more logical, calm thinking. In other words, get them out of fight or flight.
I have one question.
Yeah.
A behavioral health responder, is that literally the job title? That's what they do?
It's not exactly a job title. So most of the time, behavioral health responders are people who work in the behavioral health field and volunteer to be on behavioral health response teams as extra duties. So they may be therapists or counselors, but they may also be administrators, people who are, on outreach teams. You don't have to be a licensed therapist to do behavioral health response in disasters. In fact, Most of the behavioral health response after a disaster does not occur in a clinical setting and does not require clinical levels of care. And so,
like a qualification.
Yeah, exactly. So instead, we in Colorado, we have kind of an statewide agreed upon set of standards that if you're going to be deployed as a behavioral health responder after a disaster, you should have taken minimum these trainings and have up to date certifications in these trainings or have responded and used the information in the last few years so that you're up to speed on certain things.
Yeah.
Thanks. So it can also occur months after, like, you know, that same wildfire. It might be months after that disaster. And a behavioral health responder can provide community level, like community-based education, psychoeducation about the long-term effects of stress on the body and mind, our behaviors, thoughts, relationships. Because disasters, unlike what we see on TV, where, like, you know, a disaster happens and then, like, two episodes later, no one's talking about it, years and years for people to recover in terms of communities and things. So that's where disaster behavioral health kind of comes in.
All right.
So in my role, I also train people a lot in behavioral health emergency response. And it just so happens that a fair number of the folks that I interact with in terms of training are rescue workers, like paramedics, firefighters, and other pre-hospital care providers. So people who would already be in the field doing emergency response come to our trainings to learn about the behavioral health side of things. And so emergency medical service, EMS, frequent flyers in the trainings that I give.
So would you call those people first responders?
Yes.
Because you called them rescue workers, but previously you said first responders.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's overlap.
Yes, there is absolutely overlap. This is a not technical answer. This is a more kind of anecdotal answer, just to kind of clarify for people listening. I would typically not use first responder to categorize the folks who show up to our, not because they aren't first responders, but it's like a square rectangle thing of like the first responder category might be like much bigger than the rescue workers who show up at your trainings.
Okay.
For example, first responder almost always also refers to police. I've never trained a police officer once.
Well, fuck them. Why would you?
Howie Lise got fired from her public health job in Colorado.
Her podcaster. Yeah, because her friend said, fuck the police. Yeah, I don't think.
People know my opinion on these things.
Really? I've never had an opinion in my life.
So, yeah, so typically it's more people who are kind of on the pre-hospital care provider side than the public safety side. So that's why I have this renewed interest in CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation. I think more people know it as CPR than cardiopulmonary resuscitation. One of the few times where the acronym is actually more useful to talk about than
than the full term, because cardiopulmonary resuscitation is a fucking mouthful. And you haven't got time to say that when you're talking about CPR.
No. No, that's so true. So it is a core tool for emergency medical services, EMS. So I'm curious, Debbie, have you ever been trained to perform CPR?
Yeah, years ago. So when I was a teenager, I was in all of the extracurricular activities. Like, I did everything. My poor parents spent their entire lives just driving me around from place to place. And so I was in guides and I was a sea cadet and a whole bunch of other things. And in both of those situations, we had, I think it's called like advanced life support training or life support training, which included CPR.
Yeah.
And we had an Annie dummy.
Yeah. So what is CPR and how do you do it?
Okay. Oh God. Does 17-year-old Debbie remember anything? Yeah. No. Right. The things that I remember are you're meant to sing the song Staying Alive by the Bee Gees in your head. That gives you the rhythm. You have one hand overlapping on top of the other and you kind of roll them both into like a loose fist with your fingers interlocking. And the purpose of CPR is to If the person is not breathing and their heart is not beating, it's to keep the blood flowing around and the oxygen flowing around their body to preserve life. And yeah. So you basically apply your interlocked fisted hands to their sternum and you press down really freaking hard, yeah. harder than you think you harder need than to. You think.
Like, yep.
You're probably going to break the sternum.
Yep.
To the rhythm of staying alive. And I don't remember the numbers of, you do a number of, they're called chest compressions. You yes. do a number of those compressions and then you blow air into their mouth. It's called a rescue breath. And maybe yes. it's like 30 compressions and two breaths or something. And it's basically to try and keep that person alive until the grown-up paramedics get there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You've hit it nail on the head. So typically CPR consists of, especially layperson or bystander, CPR, chest compressions, rescue breathing. And the chest compressions, exactly like you described. Rescue breathing is where you, like you said, you blow air into their mouth. You want to make sure that you see their lungs rise and fall. Otherwise, it's very possible that during rescue breathing, the air can go in through the mouth and just come back out through the nose. So you might be taught to pinch the nose. Yes, Debbie made a little gesture of a pinch. You might be taught to pinch the nose or tip the head in such a way that reduces the likelihood that that will occur. Yeah. So, and yes, the purpose of CPR is to, exactly like you said, keep blood moving through the body so that oxygen continues to be delivered, especially to the brain, is one of the main concerns. While a person's blood is not, or heart is not beating on its own. And the goal, right, is that they are, the person whose heart has stopped and is not breathing will be transferred to a higher level of care as soon as possible. CPR yeah. is not mm-hmm. an endpoint intervention. It's a bridge. It's a stopgap.
The movies would convince you otherwise, though.
They sure would. That's actually something.
Are we talking about that later? And the amount of time that someone can do CPR for.
Yeah.
And someone can come back.
Yeah.
And just take a big breath and sit upright and be fine. Yeah. There's a particular film. It's one of the Mission Impossibles where, oh God, I can't even remember the details of it, but I think maybe Tom Cruise is doing CPR on his wife. And I like set the timer on my phone because I'd watched it once and I was like, this is ridiculous. I set the timer on my phone and she's dead for like 5 days. I don't know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, that's if she is still alive, her brain not had enough oxygen to retain function.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is the purpose of CPR, right? And actually this is the benefit of CPR. So if someone receives CPR and the sooner after their heart stops, the better, and they receive CPR, then they have, according to the Red Cross, their likelihood of surviving after cardiac arrest and surviving without major neurological damage or brain damage goes up by 50%.
Okay, but does that go up from 2% to 3% or something?
Yeah, well, so that's my next question for you. Successful? Okay.
Oh, sugar.
I have read recently in researching this how successful CPR is portrayed on American television.
100%.
Not quite. How successful Americans believe CPR is. And how successful it actually is. So I would love to hear your guesses on those
things. My guess is. Okay, yeah. Well, all right. You said it's not 100%, so I'm going to say 95% is on the telly how successful CPR is. Mm-hmm. The average is probably brought down by some like medical shows where they at least try for a semblance of reality. Mm-hmm. But all of the action movies, everyone does CPR.
Everyone comes straight back up.
Don't worry, you're fine. Yeah. Bam.
With no damage. Get
defibrillated and you just sit bolt upright. You're good. How successful do Americans think it is?
Mm-hmm.
Like 75% probably, 80%. You're all wildly optimistic, so.
Uh-huh.
And how successful is it?
Mm-hmm.
30%.
Okay, so the closest you got was how successful Americans think it is. On TV, it is about 70% successful.
What? Okay, well, I watch all of the wrong TV, obviously. Yeah.
Well, you're probably right that there's like some really gritty, like, you know, more hospital settings or even shows. I think that this factors in shows that are like true right? Let's talk about like real world examples. And so that brings that rate down. But I will say, absolutely, I watch some of these. I am a fan of some of these shows. And like the number of people who miraculously survive is almost all of them.
I am so proud of whoever did this research and had to watch.
Yeah.
Every instance of CPR.
Yeah.
And just be like, tick or cross.
Yeah.
Tick or cross.
Yeah.
Tick or cross.
Mm-hmm. Americans are about at a 75% rate, they believe.
Wildly optimistic.
Wildly optimistic. That's you lot. They believe that CPR works about 75% of the time. The actual rate.
Which is not surprising considering if the telly's showing you at 70%.
Exactly.
You're going to be like, yeah, of course, that seems reasonable.
And there is a culture in America of first responder heroism and lionism. Like there is a, and it actually, like this is another study phenomenon, like firefighters in America are more likely to die attempting heroics that firefighters in other countries know is not safe and would kill them because we have this like lionization of our, right? We, our cultural collective about them is like they're heroes, they save lives, they do. And so like there's certainly a...
Which they do, but that doesn't mean that their life is worth less than the person they're saving.
Exactly. And you also see that a lot on those TV shows, right? Like, get out of there, evacuate now. No, there's still a victim in here.
Yeah. No man left behind. Fucking leave him behind. Fine.
Okay, we were at how effective is CPR actually?
Yes. Okay, so we got in on the telly box it's 70%. Americans think it's 75%, but in reality it is, drum roll,
around 7%.
Elise.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm guessing 30%. I'm like, I think it might be like, I'm guessing too low. 7%.
7%. Oh my God. And there's a lot more to talk about in terms of actual CPR outcomes, because a lot of people whose heart stops have underlying chronic conditions. They have, and so you may resuscitate them. They may end up with severe damage to their sternum, as you mentioned. They might end up with some kind of damage, neurological damage, and things like this that then they survive with on top of having a deteriorating medical condition.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of medical personnel who don't advocate for CPR the same way that like the AHA, the American Heart Association, and the Red Cross do. But it has to be a personal choice. I mean, you can get a do not resuscitate order, things like that, if it's something that you believe in, or if you know, a lot of people really think of it as, why wouldn't I do everything and ask people around me to do everything to keep me alive or to keep someone else alive if I could, right? That we don't get to make the call of like, what is the better or worse outcome for someone? And I'll just add that there are some pretty bleak, to be honest, studies about the emotional and psychological toll that CPR has on rescue workers and medical workers, because it is, you know, you jump so in. You're told this is going to save someone's life. And I mean, think about a 7% success rate and the outcomes of how it can actually be pretty hard on people who survive it.
You do it 100 times. Yeah. You do it 100 times. 7 of those people survive. And of the 7 that survive, X percentage will have sequelae.
Yeah. Oof. And if you really want to get depressed.
I don't.
Read about the ethics of CPR during COVID. That one was, I mean, brutal. I've used the word bleak, but that was some grim, bleak stuff to read.
I know that we've got loads to cover, so
yeah,
so we won't, I don't want to derail us too much.
Derail there.
But I'm just thinking about what is the difference when a defibrillator comes into play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I can imagine that there are situations where like, okay, your heart has stopped. Mm-hmm. But the point of a defibrillator is to restart. Mm-hmm. So it's doing its own thing.
Right. Yes. So there are defibrillators is typically not taught as bystander or layperson CPR because you and I cannot use a defibrillator without training, right? It is too dangerous. It is not something we can typically do. Unless... if you're trained as like an EMT or something, like that is where it becomes, but that's like, you're an EMT if you're doing defibrillation. AEDs are the thing that people often think of, which is not quite the same. An AED is a layperson.
Yes.
Shocking device.
Can be used
device.
By anyone.
So these are the things that you'll see like just on the wall in workplaces and stuff like that. AEDs are effective when the heart is not beating normally, but has some sort of, I'm not a medical professional. I don't know all the details.
Look, if it's got like an arrhythmia.
It has
so
some,
if the rhythm is not right, too slow, too fast, arrhythmic.
There's some rhythm happening and it's got a technical term to it. It has to be a very specific thing. But if you can detect that rhythm, an AED is very effective at shocking the heart back into normal rhythm and getting blood flow reestablished. I could not tell you more than that. I haven't been trained in AEDs and that's about as much as I know off the top of my dome. So
cool. No, that's great. Automated external defibrillators is what AED stands for. I just looked it up.
Yes. Beyond that, for defibrillation, it's like that's EMT level and higher. Yeah.
The one where they go, clear!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paramedics do that shit, not lay people. Okay. And then I'm going to just quickly, the last thing I want to discuss is how do people learn CPR? So anybody can learn CPR. You can actually like find online, examples and things, which doesn't get you certified, but could at least get you through the basics. You can take CPR courses in like an hour through a lot of different avenues just by Googling it. But typically you get it through basic life support classes or if you call 911 because you witness someone go into cardiac arrest, a dispatcher will guide you through CPR. So that's called dispatcher guided CPR. So they'll ask you, do you know how to perform CPR? If you say no, they'll say, okay, follow my directions, and they will coach you verbally through performing CPR. And that's important because that comes up later and when we're talking about the studies. So dispatcher guided CPR is important to remember. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to talk us through some of the changes and why I started thinking about this topic in relationship to clinical research. When I was first taught CPR, I remember it was in my high school health class in 2005 when I was sophomore,
baby.
I think. Yeah, a baby, a sophomore in high school. A few years later, when I was in college, I worked as a camp counselor. So in 2010, I learned CPR again. And in the span of those 5 years, from health class in 2005 to camp counselor in 2010, the training had changed. I was taught different things. Mm-hmm. And then, again, I encountered an online video that taught me something different a few years later. So three different forms of being taught what bystander CPR should look like within about 7 or 8 years of each other.
Yeah.
And that's what really got me thinking, like, how on earth do we make decisions about the best practices for this when it would be really hard to do a comparative study ethically? So in 2005, the training I received was to give 15 compressions followed by 2 rescue breaths. So you do 15, 2 breaths, 15 compressions, 2 breaths, and go back and forth between that. In 2010, I learned what you were taught, 30 compressions, 2 rescue breaths. Mm-hmm. Even in 2010, that was outdated guidance.
Well, yeah, because I think I would have learned it because I went to university in 2010. So it would have been 2 years before, not 2010. I went to university in 2004. Mm-hmm. So I would have learned like 2 years before that when I was like 15, 16. Mm-hmm. So that was, 2001, 2002, 30 to 2. But also, sometimes the UK does things slower or faster than America.
Right. Yes. And sometimes the reason... Right. If the person I learned it from when I was a camp counselor was teaching it without having learned the updated guidance, right? She was just teaching it the same way she taught it for the last 7 years, the last 10 years.
Yeah.
She was still just teaching 30 to 2. In the follow-up video I watched, I learned about hands-only or compression-only CPR. And that's what we're going to talk about.
So no rescue breaths.
No rescue breaths.
Okay.
That's what we're going to talk about a lot more today. So how do we study things like best practices for CPR? Because how could we possibly know the best ratio? Is it 15 to 2, 30 to 2? Is it rescue breaths or no rescue breaths? and introduce an entirely new form of bystander CPR when it's not like we can stop people's hearts in a laboratory and then do A-B testing, right? That would be extreme breaches of good clinical practice to say, ah, we need someone's heart to stop or, you know, anything like that. So I wanted to know how on earth could they possibly be giving, how could they know that compression only works enough that they update the guidance for it to say, don't do rescue breaths, right? So here's what I learned. Like a lot of research we've talked about on this podcast, there were things that got this ball rolling. It didn't come out of nowhere. Researchers wanted to know why more than half of witnessed cardiac arrests outside of hospitals, they're called OHCAs, out of hospital cardiac arrest.
Got it.
I don't know if people say OCA or if they just say OHCA, but that's what the acronym is.
Okay.
They wanted to know why more than half of these witnessed out of hospital cardiac arrests did not result in bystander CPR despite widespread CPR training and dispatcher guided CPR. Do you have any guesses?
Well, it's a big responsibility, isn't it? And you might feel uncomfortable, like, taking that on. You might feel like, you know, what you said about kind of like the outcomes, right, of being a first responder and doing CPR and how that would make you feel. Also, the rescue breaths thing, I think, would put me off because it's weirdly intimate breathing into somebody's mouth.
It sure is.
And if, like, if someone's had a cardiac arrest and maybe vomited, you might not want to put your face on their face. You might be scared about like doing it wrong and making it worse.
Yep. Yeah. No, those are all theories that have been, you know, put out there. One theory is that many bystanders are unwilling or unable to give rescue breaths specifically, right?
Yeah.
Compressions more likely than rescue breaths because of all the things you just named. So then they don't perform any CPR actions because you're taught you must do rescue breaths to do CPR. Therefore,
I won't do it together.
Yeah, exactly. And research in other fields was also showing that oxygen saturation in blood doesn't decrease to detrimental levels for longer than we originally thought. So I believe that it's like you were saying, like, you know, Tom Cruise giving CPR to his dead wife for like way too long. It's up to like 6 minutes before a rescue breath is really necessary.
All right, Tom Cruise, maybe your wife was fine then.
Now, that doesn't mean that you're very likely to all of a sudden 6 minutes into CPR, but you know, you can without rescue breaths, oxygen saturation in the blood stays at life-sustaining levels way longer than the original assumption was about how quickly you needed to get more oxygen into the lungs. So scientists at the American Heart Association, the AHA, began to wonder if rescue breaths were really necessary as they had originally seemed. So by 1997, the AHA conducted an initial round of studies and came up with the answer that, yes, CPR should continue to use both compressions and rescue breaths. But the evidence, to paraphrase, was also pointing towards the fact that rescue breaths weren't necessary. There just wasn't any proof yet to finalize that guidance. So they were like, We think this is the direction it's going. We think it's going to be compressions only in the future, but we need people to study it. We need to know that before we can change the guidance.
That's what evidence-based medicine is.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So they moved to animal studies. And fascinating, we've been doing animal studies about what is now known as CPR since the 1700s.
What?
Yeah.
People have been like, tuk, 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 on a little mouse?
So actually, external compressions... Not until the 1900s, but when the chest cavity is open, people would massage the heart. Sorry, Debbie's really upset by that. Massage the heart to keep blood.
I'll tell you what the really upsetting bit, listeners, was Elise's mind opening a chest cavity and then putting a little finger in and massaging a heart. So it wasn't the idea of heart massage to keep someone alive. It was the physical, let me open your chest cavity graphic mime that my friend did at me down the camera.
Also, shocking hearts into normal rhythm has been something that we've been testing for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And you know, Debbie's miming what we think of, like, with the paddles on a chest in a hospital from a defibrillator. Yeah, clear. but, you know, back then it was probably just some hookup to an electrical thing where,
Nikola Tesla just messing around.
Yeah. And, I mean, obviously, like, first electricity would have had to have been a part of this. So we weren't doing electricity as shocking hearts since the 1700s, but the manual massages and things like that for was something that started all the way back then. And so, yes, we've been doing studies on dogs and cats that show, we're always the first to show that we can shock hearts back into normal rhythms, that massaging an arrested heart would keep blood flowing, and most recently, both that external compressions could be effective, so you don't have to open the chest cavity up to massage the heart, you can use external compressions, and then more recently than that, that compression only CPR is effective.
Cool.
Yep. The outcome of the animal testing showed us a few key things. One is actually the quality of chest compressions that matters more than most other parts of CPR. Poorly delivered chest compressions are not helpful. Well-delivered ones are highly correlated to improved survival and neurological function rates. So again, we're still talking low overall odds, but if CPR is delivered, high-quality chest compressions is the number one key indicator of, like,
success.
If you're going to survive, are you going to survive one? And two, are you going to survive with good neurological outcomes?
Okay.
Additionally, what we learned was the time it takes to deliver rescue breaths, especially for someone who is untrained or unskilled, is really detrimental. It results in stopping compressions for too long, right? Because when you are delivering a rescue breath, you are not delivering compressions.
Unless there's two of you and one's doing one and one's doing the other.
Right. And yeah. Even when there are two, typically you're trained to, someone's doing compressions, someone else says, pause for rescue breathing, right? And then someone comes in because there's not enough space. Unless you have what medics have, which is one of the bags, right?
The bag.
In which case you can do rescue breathing the whole time alongside compressions. But I don't have a rescue, one of the bags. I don't even know what they're called. That's like, again, that's EMT level elite interventions.
Yeah. So listeners, Elise and I are doing some very good miming at each other, which I'm conscious that you all can't see. So when we're talking about the bag, what we mimed was the mask, the plastic mask that you can probably imagine that goes over a mouth and nose, that if you've watched any hospital television, you will know. And then it usually has a pipe coming out of the top that goes to a bag.
Like a
and
balloon.
The bags that I've seen are usually green or blue.
Mm-hmm.
And there's someone usually stood by the head of the patient that is deflating the bag manually to push air into the patient's lungs. So when we're talking about the bag, it's not like a plastic bag over someone's head.
Yeah.
Would not help.
No, very much not so. Okay, so in other words, to simplify, stopping chest compressions in order to deliver slow or poor quality rescue breaths results in worse outcomes than delivering no rescue breaths whatsoever.
Mm.
So after animal testing, they did design a study using dispatcher-guided CPR. The study was randomized so that roughly half of the cases were taught compression-only CPR, so the new intervention, which is compression-only, and the other half were given traditional CPR instructions of compressions, rescue breaths at 30-2 ratio.
Okay.
That study found two key things. First, the time it takes for a dispatcher to coach a bystander to perform CPR is significantly less for compression-only CPR.
Oh.
And there's a higher rate of completing instructions. So for traditional CPR, dispatchers complete instructions only 60% of the time versus for hands-only.
By completed instructions, you mean like got to the end of their script?
We're able, exactly, to give the full length of the instructions before not specified, right? Before something interrupted or changed the outcome of that.
Yep.
Versus 80% for hands-only or compression-only CPR. So CPR was administered more quickly and with more complete guidance more often when dispatcher-guided CPR was hands-only.
Was hands-only.
Mm-hmm.
So and hands-only means compressions only, no rescue breaths.
Exactly.
Got it.
So second key takeaway, among those cases where complete instructions were given, there was no statistical significance in the difference of survival to hospital discharge, which was the primary endpoint of the study. So whether the patient survived from the point of first receiving CPR to hospital discharge, whether they got rescue breaths or not, no significance statistically of the difference in the two.
Yep.
Although there was a higher rate of survival to discharge for hands only, it wasn't statistically significant. And that's been consistent in several studies, actually, that more people across all of these studies do survive with hands only, but
it could be chance.
It could just be chance. Exactly.
It's not a strong enough signal. And this is, okay, so this is something that I think we need to talk about, because this, what does statistically significant mean? So basically, my rough understanding of it, statistics has never been my strong point, is that whenever there is a difference between two groups, an observed difference in situations, right, like a higher survival rate with hands only to hands only and rescue to hands and rescue breath CPR, the difference in those two measures in the outcomes could be down to chance, just dumb luck, right? Just one of those things. And when you're talking about statistical significance and why statisticians are so important in research, they will make sure that you have enough patients in the study, and they will determine mathematically what number is needed to show that the difference between these two outcomes is caused by the variable that we've changed in the experiment, not anything else, not chance. And this is why it's so important in research to control as many of those variables as possible, which is why you have inclusion exclusion criteria, is to try and make it so that if there is a difference between group A and group B, it's because of the thing you've done differently, not just because all of the people in group A are healthy marathon runners or whatever, and all the people in group B are unhealthy marathon runners. I don't know. That was a bad example.
But I got you. Yeah. Thank you for that. That's really important here, right? Because yes, it's like, okay, we're seeing consistently that hands-only CPR has, the numbers are better, but there's not a statistically significant difference there to say for the study to be able to conclude, for the scientists to be able to conclude that actually compression only is better. It just means they're the same. They have the same outcomes, because we can't prove one is better than the other.
One is better than the other. And it might be that it's because, let's say there's 10 patients in each group, right? And one group has 7 patients that survive and one group has 6. There's just not enough data in only 20 patients to say, oh, statistically, blah, 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 math's boring. But it could also be that the difference in survival rates, or the length of survival, if that's what they're measuring, is you will survive for 1 week if you have CPR with chest compressions and rescue breaths, or you will survive for 8 days with hands only CPR. Like, the difference is not so great to be statistically significant. So I think that's it's a really complicated, really difficult concept to understand. I don't know if we've explained it well, but it's important.
Yeah, maybe it's a topic for a later time to like dive more deeply into, but regardless,
we need to get a biostatistician in to talk about it, because I am out of my depth.
Okay, so by 2008, the AHA, the American Heart Association, updated guidance and began mass educating campaigns in the U.S. around hands-only CPR, compression only, which to this day is still the guidance for people who are unskilled, untrained, or unwilling to perform rescue breaths. Rescue breaths are still recommended for EMS, as well as in specific cases such as asphyxia precipitated cardiac arrest, which means your heart stops because you weren't able to breathe, right? So if preceding your heart stopping, your oxygen levels were dropping, you need oxygen more quickly than otherwise, because
the level of oxygen in your blood is starting at such a lower level.
Exactly.
You're already at the risk point that Tom Cruise's wife got 6 minutes in.
Exactly.
I got you.
And if the duration of cardiac arrest is prolonged, if you hit those later minute marks and you're still doing CPR compression only, then you need to start introducing rescue breathing, because you need to get those oxygen levels higher oxygen saturation level higher in the blood. Okay, now we're finally turning the corner into the topic that got me started on all of this, which is informed consent. How on earth do you get informed consent in a study where inclusion requires that someone is unconscious, not breathing, heart stopped? So we're dealing with emergency pre-hospital spontaneous situations, the very nature of comparing CPR techniques to see if one is more effective than the other is kind of a mind bender to me, because what if you do the comparison and it turns out the new method is significantly worse, and that means hundreds of people who might have survived had they received the old method didn't, because they received the new method, which feels like very murky ethical waters, in my humble opinion. Now, I want to play my own devil's advocate and say, we're not doing this willy-nilly.
Every time. Yeah, exactly. That was what that's exactly what I was just going to say, is we're not just going in and being like, oh, you know what? Instead of doing chest compressions, we're going to start swinging them around by the ankles.
Yeah, yes.
Right? This is not completely unthought about, untested, unplanned action, right? Mm-hmm. We're doing it based off, we have this hypothesis, we've got some animal studies, mm-hmm. you know, we've got some good science that's backing this up. We need to give it a red hot shot. And there's always going to be risk, right? Whenever you're trying something new or different, there's always the risk, oh no, it's worse.
Yeah.
But this is the key thing about transparency. As long as you publish, if it is worse, then no one else is ever going to do the same thing again in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And you're learning from it. Even if it sucks that it's worse and maybe some people lost their lives because of it, which is terrible and nobody wants that, the bare minimum that you can do if people have lost their lives is learn from it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there was already a good expectation, right, that the outcome would be positive because the animal testing showed that compression only works. And so, okay, how do we consent in emergencies? So I know emergencies more broadly, you know, Debbie, can you just start with your experience in the field? What happens to informed consent in emergency situations more broadly speaking, not just about CPR or pre-hospital?
Yes. Okay, so this is something that is covered in ICHGCP, which stands for?
International Council on Harmonization Good Clinical Practice.
You got it. You got that one. Absolutely. No hesitation. So in emergency situations like this, so if you wanted to study, for example, a drug that you think would improve the rate at which bones heal after a road traffic accident, you can anticipate, based on that, based on the hypothesis, based on the group that you're going to be treating, that some of these patients will be presenting to the hospital in an unconscious state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's impossible to give consent when you're unconscious. And so it's built into those kinds of studies, what's called emergency consent, right? So either if someone is with you, another person can consent on your behalf. So if I'm in a road traffic accident and you are with me, if there is a relationship between us, like if you're my spouse or my mom or my whatever, legal mm-hmm. guardian, you can consent on my behalf. Just like if a child is under the age of majority in a particular country, the parents will consent on behalf of that child.
Right.
Right? It's a similar relationship in emergency situations. So that's possible. But it is also possible to include a patient in a clinical trial if they are unconscious and nobody is available to consent for them via this emergency consent pathway, providing that it is expected per the protocol that that's the situation, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just, oh, this patient's come in for a diabetes study and they just happen to be unconscious, I'm putting them on the study. No, it's got to be specifically laid out in the protocol that you anticipate that some or all patients may present unconscious and therefore not able to give consent. And if someone else isn't able to consent on their behalf, how do you still randomize them? How do you still enroll them into the study? Right. And you can do it. And all of that process, the expectation on it, the fact that it's for this particular therapeutic area, will be reviewed by the ethics committee mm-hmm. and approved or not. And then if, when the patient regains consciousness, they will consent to their continued participation in the study. And if, when someone else presents at the hospital with them, spouse, family member, lawyer, legal guardian,
mm-hmm.
the consent will be sought from that person at the moment they present, usually. There are some caveats around if the person is a child or a vulnerable person that may not be able to consent for themselves. Somebody with like special educational needs, for example, who may not be able to understand the information that they're given. But the protections for those patients apply regardless of whether or not they're unconscious. But usually how the guidance is written or how the rules are written is that if you need to do emergency consent, don't do it in children or vulnerable populations of patients.
Mm-hmm.
Do it in the rest of the population first before you expand into those groups. And you've got to have a really robust justification for it. And all of that will be ethically reviewed in terms of making sure that the patients are consented where possible. And getting consent, voluntary consent from the patients, is the baseline expectations, right?
Mm-hmm.
The situations in which this emergency consent protocol is followed are the exceptions, not the rules.
Right.
And it's only when there's no other way to do it, like in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, that covers a lot of what I found, too. So what I did track down was some more information. And specifically, there was one study that had a really good, transparent way for me to find this information. So it was a 2010 follow-up to one that I mentioned earlier that really kicked off compression-only guidance. And the only mention in the publication of the study itself was, and I quote, "The requirement for informed consent was waived." That's it. That's all they said in the study publication. I was like, what does that mean? Well, like, is someone else consenting? Is the witness consenting? Does the dispatcher have to consent? If not written consent, was verbal consent required? Like, there's so much there that is kind of vague. And so then the article goes on to say, the study was conducted in accordance with the protocol, and then in parentheses, available with the full text of this article at, and then the website. So I said to myself, well, let's track that down. And what I found.
You're such a good detective.
Yes.
Let's track that down.
Let's track that down. So I found, first of all, a list of inclusion and exclusion criteria, just like Debbie said. The inclusion criteria was very short. The person had to be unconscious, not breathing, or not breathing normally. And someone had to have witnessed the cardiac arrest, either seen or heard.
Okay.
And so, okay, obviously, as we've covered, an unconscious person cannot consent. The witness is necessary because they have to be given instructions by the dispatcher. Dispatcher-guided CPR is part of the protocol. So the dispatcher then is going to be either giving them the old or the new instructions. So the protocol then says, and this is a little bit longer of a quote, so hang with me. Following the identification of a case of witnessed OHCA, out of hospital cardiac arrest, by the emergency dispatcher, the witness is offered CPR instructions. The witness is not informed about participation in the research study. The CPR method is selected by randomization. Randomization is done by the emergency dispatcher by the removal of a paper strip on the randomization and data collection sheet. So the dispatcher probably has a stack of these sheets. Once they see that the person that they're talking to and the person who needs CPR fits the criteria, they pull off the little strip and it says either give compression only or give traditional 30-2 CPR instructions. And then they proceed without informing the witness what they're doing.
That's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think just as a note, the randomizing by peeling off a strip, in drug trials, when I was first working in them, used to have a thing called a randomization envelope, which would be like have those perforated things at the side. Like, do you get paper pay slips? Did you ever get that? So you'd tear off the two at the side and the one at the top, and then you'd open it up, and it would have all the squiggles on the back, so you couldn't hold it up to the light and look through it. So the randomization envelopes used to be just like that, and you'd pick the one for your patient, and you'd open it up, and it would say it's this drug kit, and you might not even know what the drug kit is, but it gives you the number, and it's done randomly, and similarly, like, peeling off a thing, the paper strip, right, on the randomization list would give them the, whether they're giving compression only or traditional 30-2 CPR. That's such a vintage way of doing it. Now it's all done by computer. That's just an interesting aside. The other thing that I thought about was separate to clinical research, right? Interventional research. I think, like, this comes back to the piece around, like, behavioral research and the, we've talked about it before, the study that was done. Was it at Harvard where they got people in and they said, oh, you're administering shocks. Electric shocks? Yeah. And it wasn't. It was a behavioral experiment to see whether people... And like any kind of behavioral experiment you do, like there's... I've seen one that's like a video of people in a waiting room and a noise sounds and everybody stands up. And there's one person in there that isn't like in on it.
Yeah.
And what do they do? Like, do they bow to peer pressure or do they just go, what the fuck are you doing? And there's always the ethical... I think there's always an ethical challenge with behavioural studies because if you tell someone they're in a study, they're going to behave differently.
Yep.
But is it ethical to conduct a study if you don't tell someone that they're in it? And it all depends on, I think, the harm that's going to be caused.
Yeah.
Sorry, the harm that's going to be caused to that person, right? Because being in a room and a bunch of people standing up or sitting down, it's going to be weird for 5 minutes, but it's probably not going to do you any lasting harm. Whereas thinking that maybe you were the reason that somebody survived or didn't because you did something in a randomized study could cause
psychological
trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, the witness doesn't consent in this CPR study. And I can, frankly, like, I understand why. Like, I'm imagining if I were the witness, I've just witnessed someone whose heart has stopped. I'm in a scary, high-stress situation. I've called 911. Yep. And they're like, we're sending paramedics to you. In the meantime, I need you to do something you've probably never done before that's going to cause bodily harm to the person that you're doing it to.
Yep.
And they're like, you know, this might save their life. Go, right? And, like, you're in this extremely high-stress situation. And then
high stakes, high stress.
And imagine then that you're asked, hey, do you want to try a new kind of CPR for the good of science? No, I don't. No. Thank you very much. But also,
I don't want to be doing this, but I have to.
Don't, I'm not a lab rat right now. I am standing here with this person who I may very well know, right? Who needs life-saving care. And you're about to ask me, like, oh, just real quick, would you like to consent into a study about compression only CPR? I don't want to do that.
Let me give you the 10-minute background as why compression only CPR is ethically maybe, but fuck off.
Even if it were like, you can consent in the next like 5 seconds and then we can come back because of emergency protocols and do the whole thing later, like, I would still be like, no, for God's sake, please tell me what to do, right? And on top of that, I can imagine a circumstance where I was like, yeah, I guess, yeah. And then what if the person dies? Which, again, CPR, 7% success rate. So, like, pretty likely, in fact. And then the witness, have to live with the question, what if I said no? Or just said a different answer at all. Like, even if I said no, and then I was like, but what if the intervention, that the new one would have been better? Or if I said no, what if the old one would have been better? And they lived because I had done the other thing, right?
Yeah.
What if I could have saved them by either consenting or not consenting on their behalf, but I didn't, and so they died, right? I think that would be pretty awful to live with. It's bad enough to, like... Yeah. You know, we already know it's pretty bad to, like, the effects that performing CPR has psychologically on people is pretty detrimental. And to add this level in on that would suck. So I think it makes a lot of sense behaviorally, psychologically, like you just said, Debbie, why in this case the witness, and also, like, the witness can't consent on the behalf of the person who's getting the care in this case.
No, they can't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the end results of all these studies really did come down to the same thing. Whether or an otherwise untrained person gives rescue breaths or not alongside chest compressions, the victim's chances of survival are about the same. No statistical difference between the two groups. So it was the same. This is a different study, but the same outcome. And when we're talking over 1,200 people who were
1,200,
who received CPR and qualified into the study this way. So
interesting.
Yeah, and so the data also shows that bystanders and witnesses are more likely to give compression only CPR, that the instructions are easier to follow. And it also results in less time for errors in administering poor quality rescue breaths. And administering poor quality or slow rescue breaths does result in lower survival rates and poorer neurological outcomes. So all of those secondary outcomes ended up being the reason, not the primary outcome, which is survival to discharge, which was the primary in both of the studies that I read in depth.
Yeah.
But rather the secondary outcomes ended up being the reason why the AHA, the American Heart Association, changed their recommendation for layperson CPR to be compression only, unless you are trained, willing, and able to give quality rescue breaths, or there is some other reason, like we talked about earlier, asphyxia, precipitated cardiac arrest, etc., that would change that recommendation.
Right. Cool. And it's very interesting. Well, okay, it's interesting to me. Probably everyone else is like, yawn. What you said about primary and secondary endpoints there, because this is something that we see a lot of times in a lot of research, right? And it can be down to poor protocol design. Like, they picked a poor endpoint. Why you didn't hit that endpoint. But it can also be a way that we learn a different thing, right? So like in this example, it statistically didn't show a difference between, what was it, survival to discharge,
mm-hmm.
but it did show a difference in like compliance with the instructions,
yes.
or willingness to engage or yes. something. And so similarly, on like a research study, if your primary endpoint is, I don't know, lung function levels, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you do the spirometry, when you blow into the thing, how hard you can blow, for example, it didn't show a difference in that, but it did show a decrease in number of hospitalizations, for example, because of an asthma attack, or it didn't show a change in your like your liver function test results, but the patients reported an improved quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why you will have primary and secondary endpoints, and you will often have multiple secondary endpoints, because you want to look at whatever it is that you're changing and the outcome of it in lots of different ways. Because although it may not be, okay, it doesn't actually change the liver function in this situation, the patients feel better. Why might that be? And it could be just because they're seeing a doctor every 4 weeks, you know? But it could also be that it doesn't change this bit of their liver function, but it actually changes this over here. The body is a wildly complex thing, and we do not know how all of the different bits work, and we certainly do not know how all of them interact all of the time. This is why there's risk in clinical studies, right? Because it's not predictable. We don't know everything. That's why we do research. And so having different primary and secondary endpoints is very helpful because it teaches you different things.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, both a boon and a curse for pharma research, in that sometimes all of your secondary endpoints can show success and your primary fails and the drug goes in the bin.
Hmm.
The key thing, though, is that in that situation, you publish the results.
Yeah.
Because then others can learn from it.
Right.
Ugh. That was so good, Elise.
Oh, thanks.
So interesting.
Yeah, I think this one, like, it's just, I mean, I just couldn't fathom prior to doing this research how you could study this at all. Because I'm like, this person is
They can't
dead.
Consent. They can't, yeah, yeah, They're yeah,
dead.
Yeah, yeah,
they
yeah.
cannot consent. What are we doing? Like, especially after everything that you've taught me about good clinical practice and the requirements around informed consent and how
yes.
that is, like, the baseline. Right?
It is.
For so much. Yeah. I'm like, but then how could I have learned 3 different kinds of CPR in the span of 7 years, you know?
How did they research that to
yeah.
change their
mm-hmm.
minds, to yep. bring it in
yep.
and what is the right answer? And I am absolutely sure that like this research is going to continue and something further will come
yeah.
Down the track, right? This topic also is right up your alley in that it's public health,
mm-hmm.
it's behavioral health,
mm-hmm.
there's something questionable about consent and ethics.
Yeah.
And it's something practical that, like, you have experience of or you can get your hands on. Like,
mm-hmm.
this is an elite topic.
yeah. I was pretty happy when I kind of, like, when it dawned on me, like, I should do CPR because I felt the same way. I was like, this scratches all the itches that I get about.
This is all of my favorite things in one place.
Yeah, and it's
the
just,
little
it's
goblin,
just,
is that me?
It's just enough, like, I'm, like, the treading the edge of, like, prepper stuff, too.
Yeah. You're ready, Elise. You're ready. Yeah.
I'm not.
And I think as well, it's saying to me that we need to do more about statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
so much here about, like, it was funny when you said, oh, there's a 50% increase in survival rates. And my brain immediately went, oh, 50% decrease or whatever it was. I was like, yeah, but did that go from like
yeah.
2% to 3%?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because that is a 50% increase.
Yeah.
But it's from pretty shit to pretty shit.
Yeah. Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, like, science communication is hard. We know this because this is what we're trying to do, right? But statistics
yeah.
and understanding that
yes.
is so hard. And I think we all do a bad job of
yeah.
communicating it and understanding it. Like, oh, a 50% increase, but from what to what?
Yeah.
And
yes.
are either of those numbers relevant?
Yes.
There are so many bits of this industry where I think, oh, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I could write a protocol. I'd give that a good smash. Yeah, I can monitor studies, done it. I can order studies, done it. I could be a project manager on a study, done it. But to be a biostatistician, that's a hard no.
Yeah,
mm-mm.
Not for me.
Mm-hmm. No. And it's really funny because I was just thinking, oh, I want to talk to somebody, but I'm not even friends with any biostatisticians. Which
we're
I think tells you about, like, my
call a biostatistician
avoidance.
To be on our podcast.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. So if anyone is or knows one, like, email in. Because I want to do a good job of explaining this, but it's hard.
Yeah.
So if you want to help, let us know. Nice one. All right. Anything else that you want to say before we wrap up?
No. Do you have any questions?
No, I interrupted all the way along when I wanted to. Yeah, I did an Elise classic.
It was perfect.
No, that was so interesting. That was such a good topic. Ah, I'm buzzing. I love coming to Elise's Corner. It's so good.
Oh, thanks.
All right. You're welcome. We hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed this trip to Elise's Goblin Corner. If you have any questions, would like to get in touch, would like to volunteer yourself as a statistician, you can email us at clinical.research.intro@gmail.com. I recently read an email that we received 12 days ago because I am bad at checking that inbox, but I promise I do check it. I just am a bit slow. Please do subscribe so you get the next episode automatically. Of course, please like and subscribe, rate and review. You can also check out the Clinical Research 101 Instagram page on Instagram at clinical.research.intro. Finally, I mean, firstly, a big thank you to Elise for that excellent episode, but also a big thank you to our marvellous friend, Sam Winnie, for letting us use their incredible music for our intro and outro. I was talking to another friend of ours, Adam, the other day about how catchy this song is.
Yeah.
And I, whenever I'm editing a podcast, I'm always like humming it for the next few hours. It's
great.
A plus. As Meg would say, it slaps.
It slaps.
Yeah, I just feel so uncomfortable using slang. That's why I always have to preface it with, as Meg would say, because then it's not me, it's Meg. All right, so thanks and goodbye from me, Debbie. Say goodbye, Elise.
Goodbye, Elise.